Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play. Welcome to the Fallout Lorecast, the podcast that explores the boundaries of our knowledge about the world of Fallout. Wastelanders and Vault Dwellers, welcome back to the Fallout Lorecast. We're changing things up because we're just a few weeks away from season two of the Fallout TV show, and I thought it would be the perfect time to go back through season one and do a rewatch. And I brought with me my good buddy, who I'm starting a new show with. We're gonna tease that, a little bit of that's going on too. But also, maybe not a super secret fan of Fallout 1 and Fallout 2, one of the biggest fans that I know of those first two games, John from the 40K Lorecast. John, thank you for hanging out and talking Fallout with me.
Thanks for having me on there. I mean, I cannot express people how much I've played Fallout over the years. And yeah, starting back in the late 90s, actually, was it mid 90s? Oh, God.
Late 97? Fallout 1, I think, 97?
Yes, when somewhere in that realm.
Ooh. Yeah, but we've been doing similar conversations like that. Like, what year was that? Because we're launching a show. It'll be out in a few weeks called Retro Recall. And I'll remind you about it in the future when it's officially out. It's going to be a video first, but also audio kind of show where we discuss our favorite games from the past, see if they still hold up, and some other fun and wacky things. But let's move on and talk about Fallout, because you and I have just rewatched at least the first four episodes in prepping for this. And here's how the format's going to go. I'm going to take us scene by scene through the show, and I'm going to point out some things that I noticed, and you're going to point out some things that you noticed. And what I just want to set expectations here, because when the season originally came out, we got a whole bunch of episodes real fast, and I didn't do a breakdown every episode one at a time kind of thing. There are 100 videos on YouTube that are going to give you every single little detail about every little piece of lore and all of that. This is something else. This is I haven't seen it since it came out. John hasn't seen it since it came out. We're just a few weeks away from season two, and I want to both remind myself, but also see how it feels now to watch it again, and if I have any other observations or things that I would
add. Because the thing is, when you watch a show like this, like Fallout, where this has eaten up my life, I know this show, I know this lore, I love this concept more than most things in gaming. When you're watching the show, you're always like, well, what are they going to cover next? Well, what are they going to cover next? And so your brain is not always in the moment. It's all in the, what's the storyline we're going to? Where is this going to be? Right. And you're always waiting for that great big reveal of like, is the NCR going to be there? Where is the Enclave? Right. All these things. Once you know it, it's actually fun to go back through a second time. Because I think as a deep fan of Fallout, you almost appreciate it more on the second walkthrough, mm-hmm. where you're not trying to find every Easter egg, uncover every hint, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, like, for example, the scene with the gulper. The first time that came, I was going, oh, is it a death claw? Maybe it's a death claw. And it wasn't a death claw. And so now the whole rest of the show, I'm going, is there going to be a death claw? But this time, I've got pages of notes. I sat there watching this, taking pages of notes, and I'm noting this more like it's a literary analysis or a film analysis than I am as a fan of Fallout going, oh, look, there's Nuka-Cola over there, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's where we're coming from on this one. So did you have something else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I was going to say, the thing about Fallout 2, at least for me watching it, I don't know about you, so I watch this with my wife. Mm-hmm. Who's never played a minute.
Oh, see, my wife loves Fallout. So she's like a big fan.
My wife, I had the inverse. So I also had someone next to me who was like, well, what does that mean? Like, oh, here you go. And here you go. So, which is great because I'm super happy she watched it with me. It was great. And she liked the show. And she's looking forward to season two as well. But there's also some of those elements. And so watching it again, you get this nice little, hey. And I don't know if you've seen Silo, a show it's on, I want to say it's on Apple. Okay. There's so many streaming services, but it feels like it's Apple. Mm-hmm. Silo is another post-apocalyptic one where you're not really sure why the apocalypse happened. It's an interesting concept. It's not Fallout. It's not even Fallout adjacent. It's just post-apocalyptic.
Right.
And having seen that and then rewatching this also triggered some things, because they're also in pseudo vaults. They're in silos. There's a whole bunch of like things to it. Right. Good show, by the way.
Similarities, but different, right?
Yeah, but it is that same like post-apocalyptic bit, and it's kind of like watching this again. Everything's kind of starts triggering your brain.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So we're bringing a different perspective than when I first watched it, mm-hmm. season one, and I kind of commented on it a little bit on the show. It didn't go into a deep dive, but here, let's get into it. We're starting with episode one, and episode one starts out in the past. Well, the Great War, and yeah. It's at the birthday
ahead
party.
Of us before the end.
right,
Fallout. Yeah,
right,
it's right. Ahead of us before Fallout. So, like Terminator 2, which is now behind us.
Yes, yeah. It's funny how dates work when you do fiction. Yeah. So this is the day the bombs drop, but of course they don't know that Cooper Howard and his daughter are doing this birthday party for these other kids. Clearly that's how he's getting work now, and there are a lot of hints even in this first scene that are kind of foreshadowing other things that show up throughout the rest of the season, right? Let's start with you, John. What were some of your first thoughts on seeing the birthday party and Cooper Howard and seeing it again?
It's really more, the scene's more of a setup scene. It's kind of like, as you don't really understand who are these people. I will say the part that triggered me when I first watched it and then going back is kind of cool was, hey, why is there this same as an actor who's about to die? And mm-hmm. how is he not going to die? Was actually my original thought going through it.
Right.
And, you know, later, obviously, we're going to cover who he is. But overall, like the opening scene, I think, was meant less for Fallout fans than for, hey, like I'll use my wife who's never seen it before. What's going on? Well, this.
Yeah. And there's lots of little hints. So, for example, yeah. the television says that the president's gone into hiding. They don't know where yep. he is. We know he's on the oil rig or whatever. He's doing enclave stuff yep. because they know bombs are about to fall. Why do they know bombs are about to fall? And did they launch it? We still are. It's still fuzzy.
Yep.
It's still mm-hmm. fuzzy. We get some. OK, maybe Vault-X behind it. We get some. Tim Kaine talked about how he always thought it was the Chinese who did it. But they're still. We still have not gotten the definitive, this person pushed the button first. All we got was the intent of dropping bombs.
Well, yeah. Same thing we got in Fallout 4, where all of a sudden the news broadcast is going and then the bomb hits.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So like president's gone. They ask him to do a thumbs up and he says, well, you know, with the state of things, that sort of thing. There's hints here in Cooper's personality, his response to the guys who call him a pinko. They think he's they called somebody else a pinko, I think, or no, they called him a pinko because at this point he's stood up for not believing in what's going on, and he's been ostracized from Hollywood. It seems to be the case because that's why he's doing children's parties. And
exactly.
My sense of this is my first watching, thinking back to this, it's like, okay, he's already confronted his wife. There's already some conflict there. I think that there's been a lot more conflict here with Cooper than we've seen. And I think that some of season two hints at that with him going and meeting with Mr. House and some of the dialogue that we see in the trailers where Mr. House tells him that basically, like, I don't need to be your enemy. Like, why would he even think Mr. House is an enemy? Because he's with Vault-X. He already has a negative opinion about Vault-X due to things that he's found out. But anyway, that's just a piece of it. I think we have a Cooper who did something drastic enough to get shunned by Hollywood and to get fired from Vault-X.
My expectation, and I'm hoping that it's not just this bland, is that, he tried to expose the truth of Vault-X and the government to the general populace. He then got silenced. And, you know, we've seen this in movies and TV before where I'm going to go tell everyone and they do it, but actually it broadcasts to no one because they cut the broadcast off and then he's kind of stuck somewhere.
Something like that.
It's going to be that thing.
He had some sort of drastic thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say the part in the first episode that I liked the most was, it's a messed up one, is when the house they're in has a fallout shelter and they start fighting people off so you can't get in there.
Right. Okay. So
this
plays into what I think is the primary theme of the show, and it plays into some things that I've talked about in episodes before. And it's this show is creating a very strong juxtaposition between, and you hear it in some of the other episodes, the things that Lucy grows up with in the vault, the golden rule and all of that, the being good to people because it's the right thing to do. And it just opposes that with the things people have to do to survive in the wasteland. And the question here is there any real value in being moral for the sake of being good? Or should we all just be selfish and think for ourselves and look out for ourselves only, which is what happens in many of these different scenarios. You have when the bomb goes off, yeah, and the guy punches his buddy and tells him he can't come in his vault. You have, and I'm going to point this out as we get through some of these other episodes, but there's constantly a tension between what is the right answer. And I think the show is subtly taking us to a place where it goes both and neither at the same time. It depends on the situation.
That's Fallout, though. I mean, that's right, Fallout 2 and Fallout New Vegas.
And I think this is something a lot of people get wrong on the internet, because they'll say something like, well, according to Fallout, if you live in the wasteland, well, you should always just look out for yourself because that's always the better choice. But we see examples in the show where it shows that that's not necessarily the right choice.
Who says that? The NCR proves that the opposite. Wait,
there are people who are strictly pro-authoritarian, like, I just only look out for myself, and it's just better to look out for yourself. And then... But that's just as naive as saying, well, it's always good to do things for other people and put yourself last. Well, that's just as dangerous. Both of those things don't work. You have to find a middle ground. But anyway, let's get through the scene. We've got Grognak shows up on the television with the kids. That's fun. I love the scene where there's camera flashes that foreshadow the flash from the bomb going off.
Yep.
There's a lot of these cinematic tells and preps, and even in the music, I'm going to point this out a lot too. Orange Colored Sky is the song that starts out with. Orange Colored Sky, typically meaning like a nice sunset, but this sky is going to be orange for different reasons. You get a few different things all in this first scene that I think you're right, kind of set things off. He rides off on the horse with his cowboy hat outfit on. Right, to take his daughter. He doesn't hop in a car. He got there on a horse because that was part of his whole getup. I think this shows, tell me, John, if you think that this is what this means. I think it is. This happens a lot in TV shows and movies where you visually signify a thing in order to note a change, or that a change has already happened with the character from a mental standpoint. I think it's signaling to us that he has already changed. He is already the cowboy of the wasteland at this point, because he's already hinted at pushing back against Vault-Tec being fired for his being a communist, which is, of course, the label they give anybody who doesn't agree with them. I think this is symbolic that by this point, he is a different person.
So here's the thing. I think you're right. I missed it till you just said that.
Okay, well, that's fair. Now clearly he's closer. Not
hop on horse. Right. The truth is, horse or car, you're not outrunning an atom bomb. So it doesn't really matter which one you get on.
It's just symbolic that he is already the cowboy that we will see him become. Now, he's not killing the other people at the place. He's clearly not in threat of his life from them, so he's not going to shoot people in front of his daughter. But I think that his personality, his agenda has already flipped, right? All right, so we got to keep moving. Otherwise, this is going to be a long episode. All right, Lucy in the vault. We have the introduction to the vault, the little intro with her. Yeah, and then the whole getting prepped for the wedding. What are your thoughts on this part?
Well, I mean, this was more for me just as a fan. I loved seeing the way they did the vault, because I like calling it caricature, because that's what it was. I mean, the first Fallout, it was almost claymation the way those guys moved. Actually, some of Fallout too.
Yes.
And so seeing some of these bits in there, I liked a lot. The diversity of the vault, the way the vault functioned, that was really more what I was interested in. The her getting married thing, it was more, as we moved through this scene, it was more about like, all right, how are they going to interpret what a vault really looks like? Mm-hmm. And what I liked about it is that they did, in my mind, the right thing of they made it not really make sense, because they don't make sense in the game. In the game, they're not big enough to actually support as many people.
Right.
You can't hydroponic farm this well. All these little bits of
right?
It is make-believe. And this is a personal
a stim pack isn't going to stop your insides from pouring out when you've been stabbed with a knife.
Exactly.
But and like so, somehow even it
just
does.
The way the vault functioned, the way the doors moved, all those things. There's something about that I like that looked, you know, fake. But in a good way, because I don't like when my sci-fi gets explained to me, because it doesn't work. I mean, I run a podcast on the Warhammer 40K universe.
Right.
It is an abomination of physics. They try to keep it somewhere in there, but it is an abomination of physics.
It's more about the story than the realism.
Exactly.
Right.
And have fun with it. That's what it's supposed to be. So I liked that part of it. But I also thought Lucy, I liked the naivety of her. That was also a really nice thing, because that's also a key thing in all the vaults, right, has always been, in especially in the earlier games, but even into the later games, that the vault dwellers are, you know, kind of, for lack of, is it, yeah, it's Fallout 3. I think they're my Fallout game. So it's Fallout 3 when you're in the vault, you know, the first one
grow up outside with your dad, yeah, and 101, yeah.
Exactly, with 101. Yeah. That same style of, like, no one really understands what the real world is.
Yep.
I like that they did that, and I thought they did a really good job of it.
Yeah, they set it up very good, but they also set up the fact that she is capable. She's been trained use firearms. She's been trained in some forms of personal combat. She's been, like, she may not be as good at it as somebody who's, like, in the military or something, but she's not, like, the vault has, even in its naivete, has prepared her for certain things that kind of work sometimes.
Yeah, but and you're right, because that scene where, you know, after she fights off her now, well, I guess still husband at this point,
yeah, I guess.
She fights him off, she obviously does know how to fight, and because she has been trained in combat, she knows how to heal her own wound, all these things. And that's, again, it's a nice homage back into the game to me, of, like, because this is where it was, because as, yeah, Fallout 1, you are a vault dweller. Fallout 3, Fallout 4, you are, well, Fallout 4 is a little weirder, but Fallout 1 and 3, you are raised in the vault, a vault dweller who now goes out of the world, and in one case has to kill a bunch of rats, in the other case it's kill a bunch of rat scorpions.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, that's step one, you right, know, right. And some cockroaches. Get out
of the vault, fight some little critters of some sort. So this scene, we've got "You're the Only One I'll Ever Love" as the song, which is ironic. Okay. A lot of this music is now ironic because it sounds happy and loving, even though the terrible situations are about to happen. "Who Do You Suppose I Really Love" becomes the next song. Notice the shift there from "You're the Only One I'll Ever" to who do I love? Okay, some insecurity. Little details like when everyone's gathered together and her dad's doing the thing at the front, there's behind her, there's a speaker system, and it's a Trax speaker system. That's the brand. But it looks like a Vox speaker, like, being somebody who played in bands and knows amps and stuff. The grill on it looks like a Vox amp, so I thought that was super cool. Little details like her father, Hank, mentioning things like a better way, like teaching the people in the wasteland a better way. It really leans into the idea that the vaults are ideologically completely on board with the Enclave. To the Enclave, if you are not somebody who is pure and unradiated and a regular human being who is pristine, then you are less than human. And there are little hints that the language that the vault has used makes them think that they are the saviors of the wasteland for those poor wasteland people out there who are kind of not really even people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm interested to see how the show goes with Enclave vault relationship.
Yes.
Because depending on the game, it moves around quite a bit.
Right. So one of the things that's solidified is that the Enclave is 100% on board with Vault Tech. Some of the higher ups were probably Enclave members, all of that stuff, which is highly, I mean, we don't have definitive lines. I mean, there's a scene in the show where you have these different heads of CEOs of companies lining up at the Vault Tech meeting.
I'm just more thinking my lore is obviously all game based. Something from the game, it is a question of, like, all right, how tight is it? Because, you know, you have some of where the idea is the vaults were actually a human experiment,
right? And so, just kind of fill you in on some stuff. The prevailing thoughts throughout the other games up to this point, and goes back to the originals, is that the vaults themselves were test beds for if humanity could survive traveling to another star system. And so the idea was that you take human beings and you put them, isolate them, and then you try different variables of the kinds of things they might have to deal with in isolation in space, and you see how human beings deal with that, right? Which means that the Enclave has been tracking the vaults. They're probably tied into some sort of system that can still see what's going on in the vaults. We get little hints from Wilzig that, like, he knows who Lucy is, he knows her last name, he knows details about Vault 33. Current details, not details from 200 years ago, but, like, so there's definitely a connection going on there. We got Keep Your Coffee Hot is a song that plays after they get married. Then the Raider situation, she heals herself up with a stim pack. There's a slight little music change when she picks up the Trank gun, the tranquilizer gun.
Yes.
That feels a little bit like, oh, it's one of those video game moments of like you're getting your first weapon, mm-hmm. which I thought was cool. Also, there's a theme that plays out with the weapons that she uses. She traditionally, for the first few episodes, she uses a tranquilizer gun, but she doesn't wield deadly weaponry until episode 4, where we see a significant change in her.
Yeah.
So like that sets us up to like she's defending herself, but doing it in a non-lethal sort of way. We get the explosion that the tape that runs the background view of the sunset like catches fire.
Yeah.
Just like everything cool else scene. Is going to hell. Yeah. We just saw the world blow up. Now their world is exploding with so all sorts of fun little stuff like that. But then this all comes to a head with Moldaver, who says basically sets Hank up. Right. And he's like, OK, you can save. Give me Lucy. And I'll let these people go or I'm going to kill all everybody. And he puts her in a room and closes the door. And then she takes him right. instead. And then there's a conversation there where she says, everyone knows who I am, which is so ominous. Right. And then yeah. we come to find out that plays out a little bit more as the show goes on. And then we get the brotherhood. We get Maximus
yep.
Showing up. What do you think about seeing the brotherhood like this?
All right, two things. Unfortunately, the power armor did leave me a little disappointed.
Yeah.
Visually, I was like, it looks wonky. But
it looks a little plasticky, but
that's why.
For the most part, even the sound effects and stuff do really sell the like weight of it, though. That part.
Yeah, the sound effects were there. The movement wasn't. And again, this is someone who spends a lot of his time dealing in and around power armor, not like sure. literally, but just right. it's a lot of my day yeah. with the Warhammer. But I liked the way that they made the Brotherhood, though. What I liked was more the overall theme of being in the Brotherhood, mm-hmm. in that it was like, again, to point to other post-apocalyptic styles, it was this idea that, you know, we're grabbing dregs from the wasteland and we're going to make them and turn them into men, for lack of a better phrase. You know, they're kind of a little bit of what is that Vietnam movie that I'm thinking of that is with Private Pyle?
What is the name of that?
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. There you go. Full Metal Jacket. That's it. Yeah.
Not Platoon, but like more of a Full Metal Jacket-esque style of we're going to get these guys there. And still just that I like just kind of the overall idea, because they had obviously set up Maximus as this character who's going to come from the bottom and then move his way up mm-hmm. really through enlightenment, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. He's shown to be an idiot. He doesn't know what the computer parts are. He doesn't know right. like he doesn't even know how to fit in with the rest of the group. Like he's just bumbling around.
Yeah. But I liked even like when they go to clean the latrines, I liked this idea of they were, again, nice dichotomy. We come from inside the vault where things are pristine, yes. things are nice, things are good.
Right.
And we go outside the vault. We're not even in wasteland bad yet. We are in the Brotherhood. So those who know it, like the Brotherhood's yeah. you know, in
they've got most food. Of the
games,
they've got food.
They have food. They've got all the weaponry. Like, right. like you usually, like you when you get enough, you know, bottle caps, you go and you trade with a Brotherhood, because that's where you get good stuff from, right?
Right.
And so they're even struggling at this point. Now, again, there's a backstory to that, obviously, from some of the earlier parts of the game, but I did like that piece, that it really was, to me, it's like this first episode, I took it more as less as a Fallout fan, my interpretation, and took it more as a, okay, if I don't know what Fallout is this telling the story in a way that I would want to explain to somebody? And I thought, like, the Brotherhood, I like that scene a lot for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's good. They've got another song here that totally yeah. matches Maximus. I've been unhappy all along is one of the lyrics, mm-hmm. right? He's in this rough spot. He's lived this terrible life. His family was destroyed. He happened to become part of the Brotherhood, all of that. Right. But here, this is something that hit me during the scene. We get the flashbacks to young Maximus being saved by whoever that knight was, right?
Right.
The guy in the armor. Maximus has a Latin name. Many mm-hmm. of them have Latin names. Thaddeus has a Latin name. Are we going to find out that the Brotherhood, who normally doesn't take in recruits outside of their own members unless they need to, has mm-hmm. been in a war with the Legion, with Caesar's Legion, Kaiser's Legion, and the people from New Vegas, like the events of New Vegas, maybe some of that stuff plays out, right? We're going back to New Vegas in the second season. But are these children that were Legion children, and they fought against the Legion, and they abducted their children because they have Latin names? And you think about other Brotherhood members from other games, they don't all have Latin names.
In fact, that's actually, I'm going back.
Roger Maxson, right? You've got like Paladin Dance, like a lot of these other Brotherhood members. There's this kind of religious, kind of ancient quality to the Brotherhood, these knights and those kinds of things. But the Latin name thing is very, very common among many of them. So that I find really interesting. Also, the moment that Maximus hits absolute rock bottom, he's shoveling shit. He's as low as you can physically
scene,
be.
I love that. I love that scene.
Right. Which is another glimpse into the fact that they are showing through visuals the emotional place that somebody's at. Right. He's literally physically at rock bottom here. As low as you could possibly be in that situation. So we got that, right? Then we go back to Vault 33, and Lucy is suggesting that they go to a search party on the surface, and we have all of that. And clearly from that moment, it seems that not only is she going to look for her dad, she wants to find her dad, but I think that Moldaver's words of, like, everybody knows me, the fact that they came from the surface has her way really curious now. And it again plays into, like you noted with Maximus and the Brotherhood, that things are really stark and they're desperate for finding meaning and finding, you know, wrangling on top of each other to get better ranks and those kinds of things. But neither situation, whether it's in the vault or in the Brotherhood or in the Wasteland, is good for most people. Most people hate where they are. Even when they have plenty of food, even when they, you know, like,
well, that's that's always been a great theme in Fallout. Is it's right. Like everyone. I mean, I'll go to Fallout 3. You know, everyone wants to go outside. But why do you want to go outside? I forget the name of the kid. I want to say it's Billy that was bullying you in Fallout 3.
Oh, the tunnel snakes.
The tunnel snakes.
What was his name?
Later, you find them outside, and you have to go save them because they're about to die.
Yeah,
you know, it's that kind of thing. And it's right, because later when you get the message back and you're coming and you're near the vault, and they're leading their own rebellion to get out, and you have to go in there and be like, you guys go out there, and it's a fun choice.
Right,
you can
right.
send them out there, and then they all die, or you can convince them to stay indoors. It's one of these, it's been a great theme all throughout Fallout that I think really kind of always upped the game a little bit as they added more of that in.
It's I also think it really points to the human condition of, we judge how bad things are in relation to the things that we would rather have things be. So for example, if you are in the Wasteland and you're starving, life is terrible, you're starving. If you live in a vault and you lose your job as the guy who guards the door, then that's the thing that means the most to you in that moment, and you feel equally terrible. Now, one of those is a more dire situation for your own survival, but they both feel like they really suck in the moment, because that's the thing you're worried about. It's just the nature of humans, right? So eventually she gets outside, and even Norm mentions, he says he's too chicken to follow, which is we're establishing a character arc for Norm too. He's a chicken, but he's really just miserable. He just hates being in the vault, and he doesn't like any of the jobs they give him. But as soon as you give him a project, he's all in it, and he's not scared at all. He's the complete opposite of what he thinks he is. He just hasn't realized it yet. But then she goes outside, and you see like the dead bodies that are kind of like frozen there, not frozen as in like ice, but like have been turned into just dirt and piles of human shapes, like kind of like Pompeii. I thought that was really cool.
So you're making me think of First Citizen from Vault City when we're talking about Vault, because this is like when one of the things I really liked about the way they covered the Vault is the superiority of the Vault,
right?
And it's the combo of both, is that what you see in these first few scenes is living in the vault is better than living outside, but you also know there's an undercurrent of problem that also that
it's more passive aggressive. It's like,
well, it's Yeah, is it Potomkin Village? Potomsky? One of those. Yeah, whatever that is. But it's that style of, on the outside, it looks great, but it's not.
Right.
And so that's what you get. And so she goes out into the wasteland, and yeah, it's worse than inside the vault. But, and then that becomes the kind of the concept of the entire show.
Yeah, yeah. So that's good. We go back to the Brotherhood. We get this, you know, Maximus is being grilled.
Yeah, because his friend has razor blades in his boot and now cannot serve as a squire.
Right, and, right. So there's that whole issue. He gets asked, why did he join the Brotherhood? To hurt the people who hurt me is his initial response.
Yeah.
And we're again getting set up for a character arc. Like, he's going to move from that to something else. Are you weak? I don't want to be, like, these kinds of things. We also, and this is what I think is really interesting, there's this little mention of, like, doing things for what the Brotherhood wants for Eden or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this Project Eden, whatever this Eden thing is,
right,
is not so much a Brotherhood overarching thing as it is the pet project of this specific elder.
We just had the best weekend. My daughter came and visited, and I wanted to have an experience that everybody would have a blast with and remember for a long time. So I loaded up the I Expect You to Die trilogy on our MetaQuest 3 VR headset, and oh my gosh, we had so much fun. And you might be thinking, I Expect You to Die, wait, what does that mean? Well, imagine being a retro spy in a world that's trying to murder you on every mission, and you have to figure out how to get through the puzzles, how to not get shot by lasers, how to launch a car out of the back of an airplane. That is the first thing you do in the first game, and my son was able to complete that quest. Later on, when we got to the third game, we were setting off explosives in an underwater base. We used Chromecast to project it up on the TV, and we all played together. One person would put the headset on, and they'd look around, and they'd try to figure out the puzzles, while the rest of us would say, well, look over there, and what did that note say? And we figured it all out. It was like having an escape room in our living room for the entire weekend. We'd take breaks and go out for dinner, and then we'd get home, and I'd say, what do you guys want to do? And they're like, let's play more of I Expect You to Die. And I was like, holy crap, this is so much fun. Oh, and believe me, they died, but they also figured out the puzzles. And the settings and the characters were hilarious and really well done. There's like a storyline that goes from the first game to the second game and then to the third, and you're Agent Phoenix and they keep trying to kill you, but you keep coming back. It's such a great time. And I've been a fan of this game for a while. This was just my first opportunity to play it with her and everybody in the house at the same time. But what's really cool is that they're sponsoring the podcast, and they've decided to give our listeners, for the next 60 days, 45% off with the code you can use on your MetaQuest account. Put in Fallout Rising, capital F, Fallout, capital R, Rising, all one word, dash 8904FC. Again, capital F, Fallout, capital R, Rising, dash 8904, capital F, capital C. 45% off this amazing experience. It's not even just a game, it's an experience. Go pick it up, and if you can't remember the code, it'll be in the description, so don't worry. Oh, and believe me, I expect you to die, and have an awesome time doing it.
I think he's playing to what this elder has taught him, which is specific to this faction of the Brotherhood, and is going to be in conflict with other Brotherhood groups. And we've seen in some of the trailers for season two that it looks like the Brotherhood might be fighting itself at some point in season two, which wouldn't be ridiculous because different groups of Brotherhood have different ideas about the way they go about doing things. So,
I'm thinking when I hear Project Eden, I just go Gek.
Yeah,
every time.
But that's,
I go Gek.
So it's a Gek thing, but that's not always what the Brotherhood is most interested in that moment.
Oh yeah, no, that's
so
fair.
My thought is that this faction specifically has some sense of like where a Gek is, how they can further Project Eden, and that has become part of their, maybe that's why they've been in conflict with the Legion. I'm trying to put together the pieces of these little hints that show up that tell us more about what's actually going on than we've discovered yet. And I think there might be something there. So either Project Eden is a big thing down from the top and everybody's on board with that, but I get the sense that this faction of the Brotherhood and these specific leaders are not 100% on board with everything else that's going on with the Brotherhood. That they like Maximus, and everyone else in this scenario is more about what's in it for them than they are what's in it for the group as a whole. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's always been that thing in the Brotherhood of like, if you can go and get the biggest technology, then you get to be the biggest player in the Brotherhood.
Right.
That is what they are truly about.
Right.
Because again, everything in Fallout is selfish to a point. I think people, as you were discussing, people misinterpret this a little bit, where we become almost too selfish,
like it's the always best thing to do.
Yeah, but it's because you do have, I mean, most of Fallout is settlements. The vast majority of the time in Fallout is settlement. You play an individual character who brings other settlements together and connects the whole piece, you know, as a game into a greater story arc. But at its core, it's not that selfish. It's just a bit. But the Brotherhood is always one of those tricky ones, because they're stated, your goal is to pacify the wasteland, is to bring unity and bring peace to the people of the wasteland.
Yeah.
With lots and lots of murder.
Yeah. You know, as long as they get the technology and they keep the wasteland from hurting themselves with that technology, all of that stuff. Yes. So back at the barracks, basically Maximus is like, what did you tell them about me? Whatever. I told them you wouldn't hurt a fly. We get the sacred duty of the Brotherhood right now, or as a squire, is to protect the Brotherhood first, protect the mission second, protect their Lord third.
Yep.
So Brotherhood first, mission second, Lord third. We see that that isn't always the case with many of the members of the Brotherhood.
Yes.
They don't put the priorities in that order, which I thought was interesting. He gets branded with the T for Titus because he's Titus's squire. Then we get the scene at the end of episode one with the, I'll just call them the cowboys who are coming, they're bounty hunters or whatever, and they wake up the ghoul who is sleeping and has these little IV bags stuck to him so he won't ghoulify, probably with whatever's in those vials. And we have that kind of situation, the whole chicken thing and all of that. So
that was funny.
Yeah. What do you think about the first showing of Cooper as a ghoul? Like, it kind of bookends the episode, right? We get Cooper at the beginning.
Yeah,
Cooper at
the end. This is more as a Fallout fan. Yeah. It was odd for me because I'm like, it's a ghoul. Like, there's a couple times you have a ghoul companion in the game. Mm-hmm. What's his nuts at Blackhawk Radio. You're going to get a few times through the games that you get this. But I remember my thought was kind of like, all right, why is he here?
right?
You know, effectively, it's like, but okay, let's see what happens with this. And I like it. They did a great job, and I love where it ends up. My first reaction was, okay,
yeah,
it's a ghoul.
Yeah. Yeah. But he ends up being more than just a ghoul. Right.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's a lot more that comes from it. Right.
But I'm just my honest reaction. And it's funny. And I'm trying to, in my second watch through, to keep some of those initial bits there where it's like, okay, I see this character in the beginning of the show, who's a famous actor. So I know he's not going to die in the first 5 minutes. I mean, he could. It's always funny when movies do that, but they usually don't.
Yeah.
And now we know he's a ghoul. And again, I'm left on why. Now, again, it's because his purpose is to be the glue to take you from what happened before to what's happening now, and also explaining lots of little bits along the way, because he is, you know, however, like 300 years old at this point.
Right. Well, and you get multiple individuals with their perspective. You have the Vault Dweller, who understands the Vault. Mm-hmm. You have the Brotherhood soldier, who now understands how the Brotherhood works the hard way.
Right.
And now you have the Ghoul, who understands how the Wasteland works. And you have all three of those perspectives kind of coming together. So it makes sense that we get it laid out like that. But also, it's a fun introduction, right? Like, he kicks their butts. He tosses the guy. That the main guy, he just tosses him down into the hole. He doesn't necessarily kill him. We don't see him show back up later in the season, I don't think, anywhere. So
I think they buried him alive. I'll be honest. I'm pretty sure that's where he did.
Yeah.
I think
wouldn't it be weird if he showed back up again? Like, I don't know.
It'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. So episode one ends there. I feel like it's a really nice intro episode. It kind of bookends that way. It introduces us to everybody, gives us the foundations of their character arcs, all of that. So in retrospect, that all fits together really well.
Right.
So any final thoughts on episode
no,
one?
I mean, I think, again, my first episode to me, like the first episode to me really was more, I don't think it was as directed at me. It was more, all right, we're going to give the Fallout fans enough to show them that we do care about their universe. Mm-hmm. We are going to honor it, and we're going to do things close enough to it. But I felt that that first episode was more about bringing everyone else into it.
Yeah.
By establishing, you know, a little bit of backstory about keeping enough mystery that they want to know more.
Right. It checks all of those boxes really well and still tells a good story.
Yes. I mean, the truth is that this same story, let's just say Amazon wanted to make a Fallout show. All right. And mm-hmm. Who even owns that? Amazon? I was about to say Interplay, but they don't own it anymore.
Fallout? Who owns? Yeah. It's Bethesda. Bethesda owns the rights.
The point is, but if Bethesda said no, right, I still think this show works. That's what I'm getting at. They could have tweaked it. Right. I think the storyline is good.
Right.
I think what they were trying to do, you just would have to tweak bits and pieces here.
Right.
But I still think the show works. And that's what makes it such a good show.
Yeah, you take all the copyright stuff out. You can still do a show about vault people in the wasteland and all of that. Sure.
Because that's always the test of a good show is if, you know, and we all of us have watched a show about something that we hold dear in our hearts and it sucked. And it sucked because if it wasn't about the thing we hold dear in our hearts, we would have walked away. Be like, all right, I'm giving this two episodes and I'm bailing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. All right, let's move on to episode two. This kicks off and we get a glimpse of something that we totally didn't expect. We're inside an enclave base. It doesn't tell us we're in an enclave base, but if you know, you know.
Yeah.
Who are these scientists? You know. What are they experimenting on? Seems very enclavey to me. And Wilzig goes through a situation, of course, where he has this discovery, but he doesn't want to reveal it to everybody. He also keeps a dog for himself that he trains, which is super fun because dog meets, there's always a dog meet. And we also get a little glimpse of the super mutant hand, which is fun on the gurney. Which I'm hoping we get super mutants in season two.
We have to. I'll be honest. We have to. I think we'll all be super mutants and Deathclaws. They're just things that we have to get.
Well, they've shown the Deathclaw in the trailers. Right. They've shown Rad Scorpions in the trailers. We've seen feral ghouls in this season. We haven't seen a full super mutant. I feel like that's what they're holding back. They're not gonna give us that until we actually watch the season.
Yeah, I'm hoping they're doing that because it's Marcus.
Oh, do you think Marcus is gonna show up? Oh, that's interesting.
Well, they're in Vegas.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is totally gonna sidetrack me, but like you could have there's a few different super mutants that you could pull into this. Okay, we're gonna have to we'll do this later after season two.
Yeah, they're going to New Vegas. I'm just saying Marcus is a very important character for a lot of us, and Marcus would give them. I mean, man, it's horrible I'm saying this because no one who writes the show is going to hear this until after they've written it. But if they have written it, you didn't put Marcus in it, you have to feel really stupid. Because Marcus would have been the best way to tell the story of the super mutants. You could have had something out of Enclave or Brotherhood of Steel giving some information. But then you have whatever wasteland warrior it's going to be. Mm-hmm. It can even be the ghoul sitting down with Marcus and Marcus explaining that story that he tells in Fallout 2 of, you know, how he doesn't hate the lone wanderer and all these things, and it's all that whole,
it gives you process. Some humanity to the super mutant sort of thing, which also gives you the question of like, well, are they all like this or are they like ghouls and some of them aren't? Guess what, not all of them are like that.
That's it.
So that would be cool. We get little details in the Enclave base, like on the hatch in Wilzig's room there's a 2076 is the number on the hatch.
Yep.
Which I thought that was cool. Also the scene where Dogmeat protects him, the guy discovers what's going on. He's in his room.
Yep.
And then Dogmeat protects him, and then Wilzig gets blood on his hands, and that's why he has to leave. It's another showing you literally he has blood on his hands. Literal
blood on my hands. Yep. And
even though he is not the guy that killed him, it was the dog who was protecting him, but he has now blood on his hands, so he has to run. And I'm still surprised every time I see the scene of like the I love the turret that pops up because it's true to the games. But how does it not hit them? I mean, it's shooting like dozens of bullets.
This is my favorite like trope in all of sci-fi, is that you can, no matter how far you go in the future, the ability to scan for things or aim just disappears. I'm gonna sidetrack us really badly, but I have to. Terminator Resurrection, that's the one set in the future. has one of my favorite movie scenes of all time, because they're sitting there and it's getting dark, and someone says, we can't go on it, go out at night, because the Terminators use infrared and they'll find us. And the next scene, they're sitting around a fire.
Right, which would be a glaring bright light on their infrared.
You just look at going, like, I remember I audibly groaned in the theater when I saw that. I'm like, come on. God.
If you're going to use technology reasons, then make sure it makes sense at least.
Exactly. Follow them for or at least give it 30 seconds, man.
Come on. So we get the enclave scene. Wilzig leaves. Mm-hmm. We've got Lucy, like, walking around in, like, the desert or the coastline, which is now huge, or whatever, and she comes across, like, the bones of this family that's there. The song is "Don't Fence Me In." She's finally leaving the vault and walking around. I thought that was cool. We see an assaultron in the sand. That was cool. The table with the skeletons is dark for a few reasons, because you've got, like, the child skeleton, the baby skeleton, too, which is super dark. But then you learn that they poisoned themselves. They gave up. And that poison was made by Vault-Tec.
Yeah, this was also one of those I loved, because it brought back in the Fallout dark humor. And so, little diatribe here, sorry. I am, of course, one of the Fallout people who feels that Fallout was better in Fallout 1 and 2 and the later ones, because it was funnier with the darkness. And so they had to make a suicide pill. What do they call it? Plan D. And that is really messed up.
Yeah, that is really messed up.
Funny. Yes, and I love it. And that's what I'm saying. That was the first bit up where I was like, I got to laugh, because that's what I really want to do with Fallout. With Fallout, you want to laugh at the darkness. That's what makes the game so good,
right?
And what makes the universe so much fun.
Yeah, it's all the dark humor. So you get her wandering around. You get let's see. I actually skipped up. You can hear my paper. My notes. Mm-hmm. There's some Foley work here. So we have the scene where she's, like, sleeping next to the fire. Wilzig shows up, drops the name Moldaver. That there's some like connections going on here. The conversation about doing what it takes to survive. Again, the theme of, like, what does it take to survive? Is that the most important thing, or do sometimes morals actually matter? It's kind of hinted at a little bit. This conversation, stay, must adapt, become a different animal altogether, talking about the evolution of the cockroaches and all of that. But it's not about the cockroaches. It's very plainly saying, like, if you are going to survive, you need to change. And then we get, again, analogies about that with the ghoul, and the ghoul even later on saying, like, you're just like me, you just don't know it yet, that kind of stuff. So that whole scene, I don't know if there's anything else to point on that scene.
Not really. I mean, I thought that scene was, we're starting to bring the characters together. But again, the main thing about that scene was just kind of to move it forward. The most important part was, it's the wasteland, is this idea that you have to adapt to this. This is real now. And I think it's also a piece that does what Wilzig's pointing out is also an error the Enclave has made. The Enclave, the truth of the Enclave, in my opinion, because again, you are the lore master on this. I am not. But the truth about the Enclave to me is always that the Enclave had an idea and the experiment got out of control. That's what happened with the FEV virus. It's what happened with a bunch of the stuff that the Enclave does. They have a plan. It gets out of control and they're unwilling to adapt to the new version of it. And they're trying to force the world back into the old one.
Yeah. So they're stuck on their goals, but they don't realize that they need buy-in and coordination from other people. Mm-hmm. And how do you get buy-in and coordination from other people? By caring about them. Right? Like, it's missing that human component, which never works. So we get the vertebrate scene with Titus, and, clean my cod piece and all of that. Clearly, Titus is, and it's an exact, what's so wonderful about the show is we just got the conversation about how in order to survive in the wasteland, you have to be different. You have to think about things differently, but you have to put yourself first. And then we have a scene that shows a character who clearly doesn't care about anybody else, who only cares about himself. And the fallout of that, is that he ends up in the bear den and gets mauled. Yeah. And left for dead, because if he had given Maximus a shred of humanity, Maximus probably would have helped him out and given him a stim pack. But he didn't. And so this is an exact scene where it shows that fending for yourself first all the time leads to freaking death, because then nobody cares about you and you have to band together. And so that whole scene, do you have any thoughts about like Maximus and the dilemma?
Not really Maximus. So my thoughts on that scene were more, again, I was more of the scene itself. First, they gave me a Yagwai, which was awesome.
Yes.
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
What I thought this scene was it was meant to be that grow up moment for Maximus. Mm. Is this element of, you know, this is your chance to be evil, but also be good at the exact same time.
Well, he's also evil by neglect, not by action.
Yeah. So he could have saved Titus,
right?
But he chose not to. And what the underlying, I think, theme around that is that what do you gain by saving Titus? Titus is bad for the wasteland.
Yes.
That is, he's
bad for everyone individual. Except for Titus, and even for Titus he's bad because he got himself killed exactly. by a bear.
So Maximus lets him die.
Yeah,
that's it is, and that is what happens in the wasteland. The people in the wasteland, to your point, who are light years selfish and light years focused only on themselves, will eventually find that they cannot survive on their own.
Right.
They need others,
and because it isolates pushing
others
you.
Away,
right? Mm-hmm. It isolates you, and nobody can survive by themselves. Yeah. Yep. And I love the irony here. In the moment where he tells Maximus, go look and see what's in the cave, that's the moment that saves Maximus, because the bear is behind him.
Yep.
So his selfishness gets himself killed and saves Maximus at the same time. Yep.
And Maximus has this great little grow up moment there.
Yeah.
That's incredible of like, okay, well, now what do I want to do? And again, they go, they go back. I don't love Maximus in this show. I'm going to call it out right now. And the reason I don't love him is I think they wrote him a little too naive. I'm okay with him being naive. I'm okay with him being, I want him green, not naive. Mm-hmm. And I felt that they made him more naive than green. And that's where I never really connected with the character very much, because I felt more like he was annoying. It's kind of how I would describe
it. I also think that they've painted him very, very unintelligent. He's not just unaware of things. He just doesn't put two and two together very quickly.
Yeah. And that's like that. To me, that's the mistake. I'm okay with this being someone like, you know, Lucy obviously is supposed to be naive. That's fine.
But she's clever.
Exactly.
And capable at the same time as being naive, whereas Maximus just doesn't seem to be for most of it.
No. Yeah. And like, you kind of like, if Maximus just died, you'd be like, yeah, okay. Like that's kind of like what you expect to have happen with him. So it's like, I kind of,
do you think that's because he is eventually going to become a villain?
Maybe. Like, I think it's poor writing.
I like to take things and go, okay, well maybe this is poor writing, but that's not that interesting.
Yeah,
and maybe you're right. Maybe it's just poor writing, but we're also only one season in. And if these writers are worth anything, then they've already written their 5-season arc. They know where things are going, right?
And
so if that's the case, our assumption usually is these are our 3 main characters. Even though they might seem terrible now or annoying or dumb or whatever, they're going to have character arcs and they're going to come out as good guys in the end or heroes in the end or something like that. That's traditionally your expectation. That's subconsciously what you expect going in. But I think the surprise we're going to get in the long run is the ghoul refines his humanity. We had a glimpse of that in, I think it's this episode where he saves the dog. He didn't have to save the dog. There was no reason to save the dog, but there's a shred of humanity still there. We're going to see that Lucy grows up and understands that things are more complex. The answer is neither black nor white. It's gray, but she learns how to navigate the gray. And then the other option is Maximus either becomes a good leader and gains wisdom and knowledge, and that's his arc, or he actually becomes a villain because the whole system was against him from the beginning. And he was never able to put two and two together to figure out the better way to do things.
Yeah, the way I see it is what they wrote in was effectively 3 lone wanderers.
Yeah.
Is what this was meant to be. One of them, in the case of the ghoul, has a very significant, he has a real purpose and he has a goal. And whereas Lucy,
what do you think his goal is?
To destroy everyone who caused all this, because he's got a goal.
This will be fun because we don't know yet. So I think his goal is to find his daughter. I think he thinks his daughter is still somewhere. She's still alive. Well, somewhere.
He's hinted at that too. He's hinted at his daughter and his wife both may still be alive.
Right. Well, I think he and his wife are separate. That's why he has his daughter with him at the party.
Yeah, but he's still, I mean, that's the thing. He still cared about his wife. I could see that. But he also, I think he's trying to hunt everybody down. That's maybe what he's trying maybe to do.
Yeah, that might be part of it too. Yeah.
I think Lucy is the one who's going to more like, again, I'm going to go in individual games here, but she's going to be more like the New Vegas one, where she's going to end up in a situation where it's going to, a lot of the future of humanity is going to kind of go through her, the decisions she's going to make.
Right.
And I look at Maximus as almost the anarchist, the unintentional anarchist out of the group, mm-hmm. not the I want to burn it down, but to your point, the unreliable one who's just going to kind of do stuff and it's sometimes will benefit, you know, the other
wild
card. Wild card. And other times will actually be a detriment to the other lone wanderers because of decisions he's going to make that are largely selfish.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to see. Like, that's part of what's fun about the show is that we just don't know yet, right?
We don't, yeah.
So, yeah. It could go, and who knows, maybe by after the end of season two, my perspective is going to change. Like, I am totally open to, and this is something, again, I think most people should be open to, changing my opinion when presented with new evidence.
Oh, yeah. Happy amazing to do it. Amazing. I'm okay with being wrong. The only time I'll push back on this show is if they just decide to all of a sudden rip off Fallout 2 or New Vegas and just take a new route with it. Like, hey, no,
I think, I don't think the writers
don't you touch
do
my baby like that. No,
yeah. No. They're going to, I mean, they're obviously talking about New Vegas stuff. They're taking the New Vegas story a little bit further in season two because it's in the location, but I'm pretty sure that like for this being its own story, it's all planned out and connected already.
Oh, of course.
And they're not going to just be like, oh, well, now you get to be the same character as this guy in this game for this episode. You know, that kind of thing. All right, well, we got to get through this. So there's the whole cave thing. Lucy, we go back to Lucy, and let's see, where is she? I'm going to scrub through the visuals here. Oh, yeah.
The town is Philly.
Yeah. She's on her way to Philly. She sees, like, the poor guy. Did you notice the poor guy who's like, you can just stay with me? He walks slumped over like the poor people from, like, Fallout 1 or Fallout 2.
Yes.
Kind of hunched. I'm pretty sure he just got that from the game and he's like, oh, I'm gonna walk like those guys. The actor did. I thought that was pretty cool. Then we end up with she goes into Philly, she talks to the lady, there's all these baubles and like all sorts of fun things in her shop that are callbacks to things you see in the games.
It's your first glimpse at bottle caps.
Yes,
bottle caps. It is everything in it. Some of the weaponry on the wall. You're right. I mean, this is one of those little, like, I don't like using that term Easter egg. It's not that well hidden. This is more just those little, like, all right, let's make sure we're feeding the Fallout fans.
Yeah, the fan favorite stuff. Yeah.
Even the way Philly was set up reminded me, and I've forgotten the name of the town, when you come out of Fallout, in Fallout 3, come out of the vault,
Megaton.
Is it Scrap Town?
Megaton.
You're right. It gave me, obviously, it was lacking an atom bomb in the middle of it.
Sure.
But it did give you a little bit of that more Megaton, like shanty town style of, no, they built this town.
Right.
As opposed to some of the stuff we get in some of the other games.
Yeah. So by episode two, we're fully immersed in, okay, this is how Wastelanders live. We can see that. Everyone's just, again, only worried about themselves. Nobody gives each other much time at all. There's no trust. Everyone just kind of coexist together, right? And then you have the big fight, right? Wilzig is there, the ghoul's there looking for him, and then there's the big fight. He gets his leg blown off. Then you have Maximus shows up in the power armor. And one of the things about this scene that I thought was interesting is that the ghoul stands toe to toe with Maximus in his power armor for two reasons. One, Maximus doesn't know how to use the power armor yet.
That's a big piece of it.
He's just flailing. Yeah. And the ghoul even says something like, maybe read the manual, which is funny because do the manuals even exist anymore? Probably not. But also, Cooper mentions that he served in the military. He's familiar with the power. He probably even used power armor, if not served next to people. I think he even mentions it later that he did use it at some point.
Yeah.
And so he understands like its vulnerabilities. He also understands what it looks like when a green new recruit tries on power armor for the first time and can't seem to be able to fight you very well. So that plays out really well, in my opinion, of the, like, they kind of stand toe to toe. It's a little cartoony, but.
But the cartoony thing also did have, but again, as we've said, discussed, I am a Fallout 1, 2, even tactics players where I put the most of my time in the games, right? Some of those fight scenes were that kind of cartoony. So I liked the homage right there to it.
Well, even like it feels like he doesn't have a Cooper the Ghoul doesn't have a Pip-Boy on, but it does feel like he has VATS because he can just like target people and shoot them really accurately.
Exactly.
And then he gets shot in the back a little bit and has to sit and eat the tomatoes, which feels like he's healing himself up a little bit, letting his AP come back so he can stand up and shoot some more guys. Like that scene, like it doesn't say it. Is that's what's happening?
But it was a fun little like it. Yeah, exactly.
Because that's what you have to do in the game. You're like, I'm going to take some cover over here. I'm going to wait till I get my stuff back. Okay, now I'm going to pop back out and shoot somebody. Yeah, that's what that feels like. But then there's all sorts of little details, like the dentist / barber. Barbers historically were medical people. They didn't just cut hair. 1,000 bottle caps to kill the ghoul is what she says in order to get somebody to shoot him, which 1,000 bottle caps is a lot, which means that
it's
the price on Will's egg's head for that technology it's got to be more than 1,000 bottle caps. So
you're right. We never know what the price on Wilzig is. And it's more given who put the price on his head. My guess is
Moldaver.
It's more of a information and power than an actual like revenue stream, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. It's well worth whatever that price is, which is to power the wasteland and all of that. Poor Dogmeat gets stabbed, but we talk about how the ghoul brings him back later with the stim pack. There's a few other things. I need you to take these to my client, Ma, the lady at the shop says, serums to heal your feet. So it's about the thing that they put on Wilzig's foot, you know, like, all that's just pretty funny.
Well, that's why, because it's got this like almost caricature-y wastelandy thing where, all right, well, because we're both in the future, but we're not. You know, in that regard of like, all right, this is what, 2077? No, that's when the bombs fell. This is
2293 or something like that. 219 years later. So whatever that math is.
So we're at that point. So of course we're not just using the same prosthetic limbs we were using when pirates were around. You know, it's gonna have a bit more oomph to it.
Right, in a very Fallout sort of way, where it like grinds your stump and then cauterizes it, and then.
But also doesn't really work quite the way you'd want it to. That's always the thing in Fallout. Everything's like, I mean, is this going to make me better?
It's what's crazy is that with modern technology, phones, the internet, the inshittification of things, which is shortly stated as how bad can we make this in order to save cost, where our customers will still buy it. Yeah. That's how technology works today, but Fallout 1 and 2 in the late 90s already got that concept. They already figured that out because they understood what happens when monopolies and capitalism runs riot, runs crazy and that kind of thing.
I was assuming these were engineers who were just living in, hey, shouldn't we have flying cars by now? And instead, like, we had cell phones that weighed more than a brick.
Yeah.
You know, it was that kind of thing. And I think the idea of Fallout, like, at least original Fallout, Interplay, correct? Is that that's who did it?
So
the Interplay, the engineers, was more, it doesn't get better, guys. It just gets it gets more advanced, but it doesn't get better.
Right. Everything's still kind of crappy, even though it's more sophisticated.
Yeah, like we can make cars that have fusion engines in them, but they'll still break down and be annoying.
Yeah.
Type thing.
Yeah. So this episode ends, Wilzig and Lucy make their way to the crashed Chinese satellite. CCCP. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you got to take off my head. It's the part that's valuable. Take my head with you. And she has to use the little chain saw thing. Mm-hmm.
Because he was injecting stuff, or he was storing something in his head.
The cold fusion thing, whatever it is stored in like the back of his head. And this scene is another one of those. Every episode has a moment that pushes Lucy further than she'd been before. Now she has to cut off a human head and carry it with her. And we'll see in the beginning of the next episode that she acclimates to that pretty quickly.
But again, it's because she is the lone wanderer. That's what Lucy is meant to be at all times. This is the only, like, literally, it's actually literally the only knock I have on Fallout 4 is I'm not a lone wanderer. I have an actual purpose, and everything else, I don't really have a purpose. Fallout 4 is a great game, really good game.
Right. But it tells the story for you, and you have to play in their story rather than making the story
more so than any other game. Well, maybe Tactics, but that's a me thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's a common criticism before, is that like people would rather have a silent protagonist. They'd rather have you come up with the reasons why you're going to go do stuff outside of just like, you know, like Fallout 1, go find the water chip. Like, that's your whole purpose. But outside of that, I don't know, just go places and figure stuff out.
Water chip and then the origin
and then later
of the mutants.
Yeah, yeah. And then it changes.
You could swing through down to the Boneyard and see what's going on with the Church of Adam. And then, but that's why Fallout 1 was so wild. Is mm-hmm. right? First time right. I actually did play Fallout 1.
Right.
When, like, not at release, but close to release. And it was this moment of like, whoa, like, what am I, wait, where do I have to go now?
Yeah. But as with any of these games, it's like, it's up to you how you're going to spend your time. It's just, it's weirder when your conversations in something like a Fallout 1, if you go on a side quest, are all about the side quest. But in Fallout 4, it was more about like, yeah, I'm still trying to find my kid, like here and there all the time, which kept you focused on, okay, I guess there really is a main mission here, which was their intent. But it takes away some of that personal freedom to make your own story.
It almost felt like the developers were mad that they knew all of us would just go do side quests forever, like in Witcher 3, where I actually, every time I've played Witcher 3, I've had to go and read notes of why I am. Because I'll do like 30 hours of side quests and come back to the main quest going, so what was going on exactly? I haven't actually played the main quest in 2 months of my actual life. Where are we?
That's a whole RPG thing, but
only spend so many hours in Gwent.
Right, so we got to wrap up this episode because we got two more episodes to talk about on the next episode of this show. How'd you feel about episode 2 kind of wrapping up the way it did?
I like episode 2, the character arcs are now beginning. Episode 1 was what's going on. Episode 2 is character arc, and we're getting a first little hint at what the storyline's going to be. Mm-hmm. We now know, all right, there's something in this guy's head, and we know that Lucy is going to be getting chased by the ghoul in order for this thing to get there. So we know those two are there. What I do like is that we didn't realize how much other stuff was still going on. This is where I think, as with all shows, you know, it's an 8-episode series, you know, or season, whatever you want to call it. And they always, the first one is the establishment. And at some point you got to begin the arc, and they arced hard. We're about to get into a lot more information. I mean, we're going to be everywhere we bounce is going to be telling quite the story soon.
Right. Yeah. I like how all of their paths come together very cleanly here and around the same MacGuffin of the, you know, the tech inside Wilsig's head. And everything kind of comes together, but we're starting to see each of the characters not just in their element, but now outside of their element. And starting to adjust, and that path is now moving forward, which I feel like was done really well with a lot of, fan service stuff showing up all over the place.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool. So, all right. Well, that's episode 1 and 2. I will be back in a minute. Don't go anywhere. I'll be thanking my patrons and all of that stuff. And we're going to wrap up this episode, but make sure to join us for the next episode because we'll be talking about episode 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And if you are interested in checking out our other show, Retro Recall, again, it's not up yet, but there will be more notifications in future episodes of when it's up. It is coming just a few weeks, so get ready for that. We'll be talking about like Mega Man 2 and Double Dragon 2 and other 2s, but also not 2s.
We eventually stop playing 2s, so it does take us a few shots. And sorry, guys, the problem is when you're playing early games, some of the ones were kind of, you know, crunchy.
Yeah.
You know, so it's nice to get into some of the 2s where it got really good. But we also play some first runs like Earthworm Jim and... Well, I guess Duke Nukem 3D is also technically a sequel, but that's not important.
Yeah. It is. But you're going to get lots of nostalgia and that kind of stuff. Retro Recall. Go look it up in a few weeks. All right. Taking a quick break. Be right back. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We will be covering episodes 3 and 4 of the Fallout Season 1 in the next episode of the show, and we'll get through eventually all the episodes before the next season launches, so that's exciting. Also, thank you so much for everybody who supports the show. Welcome to Jeb B, who signed up on the Patreon, patreon.com/falloutlorecast. Check out everything on there. You get ad-free episodes. You can join us for our patron chats. I'm sure we're going to be discussing the TV show, so if you want to be a part of that, don't be shy. Come join us. We'd love for new people to come join and be part of that conversation. Also, thank you to our current sentry bot, Dusty Ray. And we've got a new review. This one is from Vool on Apple Podcasts. If you live in the US, you can leave a 5-star review with an actual bunch of words in there, and I'll read them out on a future episode like I usually do. It says, Thank you for the lore. I've been listening to this podcast for a while now and have wanted to learn more about the lore of Fallout, and I stumbled across this podcast. Let us traverse the wasteland in style with robots through the wasteland as our narrator. He does such a wonderful job of giving us a sense of understanding the wastelands more. Keep up the good work. And sorry, I can't read very well, but thank you so much for taking the time to do that, Vuel. I hope I pronounced the name correctly. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I can't wait for you to check out the next episode of this. Also, Retro Recall launching on the 19th, as of the plan right now, November 19th. So go check that out as well. When that comes up, I'll be posting links and stuff everywhere, so you'll be able to find it. So thanks, everybody, for the support. Looking forward to the next episode. Stay safe in the wasteland, and I'll see you next time. To plug into everything else we're doing, check out robotsradio.net. Reach out to me on Twitter at robots_radio. Check out the Robots Radio Rocket Club, where you can join me and a bunch of our other creators creating your podcast, starting a new podcast, or helping your current podcast grow. There's more information about that on robotsradio.net as well. And you can always talk with us and the entire community, over 2,000 people, on the Robots Radio Discord. Come join us. We'd love to chat with you. See you guys next time.